Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And folks, you know, every once in a while, Tammy and I will talk off air. And so I will kind of dive into a conversation once I get through these obligatories. But it's now or never. That debt is fraud. Learn, pray, and act. We need to know what we're doing, and we need him in helping what we need to do and helping us understand how, what, why, where, all that type of stuff. So in our appeals to heaven, learning and understanding is pretty important. Next, that's how we start coming to the knowledge that full compliance to the law is what we have to demand and we have to expect out of all of our public servants. No compromise. See, I don't want to go down the path of getting into the rat holes, because the last episode, I apologize for doing so much. So now we can kind of dive forward with Tammy, who, don't tell anybody, but she's still muted. And so we'll talk about what we just talked about, so that you kind of get to look forward to going into Constitution Month. Because it takes usually about a month or two to go through what every line of the Constitution means. And I really want to try to, you know, stay out of long elaborations over, you know, particular clause or so forth. But in talking, because we kind of talked about what Pendleton talked about, in explaining jurisdiction, appellate, and all of that. And so most people, when they hear this stuff, because I commented, I think a lot of people just get confused because the words are not within their jargon, right? It's not something that, that's what, I know exactly what that is. And, you know, and you can understand all of the other associated jargon. You know, if you're an IT person, you kind of understand shells. You understand, you know, packets, you know. What do those mean? I mean, there's very specific disciplines that kind of understand that. And just like medicine, everybody has their own jargon, right? So this is legal jargon. And legal is kind of important when it comes to government. Why? Because we create a government, and then we create a legal system to constrain that government, or basically to ensure that the government that we've created and the laws we've created are being properly abided by. In a republican form of government, the law is our king. If you just have a king, then whatever he says is the law. That's the difference. This is why we said no more kings. We're going to create a government that is based on the rule of law, and we're going to give them very limited things that they can create law on. Therefore, the jurisdiction of that government, by giving them defined powers, limits their legal reach to those things only. We're going to get into this with Madison in just a minute here. But what I've asked Tammy to do, because we're going to get into the Constitution in just a little over a month and a half away, right? September 17th is Constitution Day. So that's when we kick off, and shoot, I haven't even looked it up, but let me look it up while I'm trying to yap. excuse me, folks. So when I look at September 17th, right, and it's going to be, what, on a Sunday. So we will kick off Constitution Day on the 18th. And, well, technically, I take that back. We'll probably do one special episode where Tammy will kick it off, and we'll do those shows that week. So we'll have to suck it up. But I will still maintain on that Friday, and on the Monday, I'll be trying to bring other content.
Wait, you're looking at August. No, September 17th is a Wednesday.
Am I? Oh, okay. 17th is a Wednesday on August. You're right, I was looking at August. While I was looking at, the first thing that pulled up was July. I thought I'd moved forward 1 month, and I did. Anyway, because we pre-record these shows, by the way, folks, so technically this is still July. What's important is that on the 17th, that's when we'll start working and going through the Constitution 3 days a week. In so doing, we're going to dive into Article 3. And I've asked Tammy to go through Article 3 and take every word that, you know, admiralty, maritime, you know, and admiralty law, maritime, and stuff, so that she can kind of provide what those words mean, how they're defined, so that as we look at this, we can kind of understand, oh, okay, that really has nothing to do with the states. That has nothing to do with you. You don't live in an admiralty world. You don't live in a maritime world. If you're a sailor and you're, what do you call those guys that, they're not sailors, but they're, there's a word for it, where they get on ships and they kind of just, they live on the sea by moving commerce or what have you. I forget what they're called. Longshoremen.
Mm-hmm.
There's longshoremen, and then there's the people, the guys that are on ship, and I know I've got a few texts. When this show airs, I will be getting the correction on what those guys are called. But there's a special name for, they're not sailors, they are blah, where you know that these guys live on the ocean and they work for the ships that move the cargo. So in the old days, there wasn't a monopoly on moving the cargo. For the most part, as corporations started monopolizing the ability for you to be that merchant marine, I think that's what they call it, merchant marine, your ability to do that kind of goes down, because instead of being a merchant marine and a union that these ship owners, these people that buy their own ships and they go and move commerce and so forth, they hire merchant marines to do the work instead of, you know, creating a company and taking that huge investment. Because when they're not working, when they're not floating around, they don't need to employ people. So the merchant marines get laid off, whatever. And that's the life of a merchant marine. But the point is that with monopolies like Matco, or, you know, I forget the name of the global company today. I believe it's Matco. And I believe it's China-owned. Owning the shipping is basically how you cut your costs, how you can seize better control. Because the United States was doing this with their corporations. And then a monopoly started forming in the shipping lanes, to where everything is moved across international waters by just one or two or very few companies today, instead of, you know, the big competition that they used to have. So anyway, I digress. Tammy's going to be bringing that to the table so that when we read those things, she'll actually have, okay, I'm ready for this, and that's what this word means. So there you go. Isn't that great? Because I've never done that. And so anyway, thank you so much, Tammy. Yay, Tammy. So we just finished with Mr. Pendleton talking about common law. And now we go down a little further the same day. Mr. Mason gets up and makes some comments on common law. So let's go ahead and dive into that.
Okay. A discrimination arises between common law trials and trials in courts of equity and admiralty. And these two last depositions are committed to record, and therefore, on an appeal, the whole fact goes up. The equity of the whole case, comprehending fact and law, is considered, and no new evidence requisite. Is it so in courts of common law? Their evidence is only given viva voce. I know not a single case where there is an appeal of fact as to common law, but I may be mistaken. Where there is an appeal from an inferior to a superior court with respect to matters of fact, a new witness may be introduced, who is perhaps suborned by the other party, 1,000 miles from the place where the first trial was had. These are some of the inconveniences and insurmountable objections against this general power being given to the federal courts.
Okay, so right
gentlemen
there.
Will perhaps...
Go ahead. So when you say via voca, in common law, when they're giving evidence, when they're giving testimony, they didn't back in those days have stenographers. In other words, if what was stated wasn't really a part of the record. In admiralty... And in, what was the other one, equity and so forth, that they actually took down, because where are common law courts? folks, common law courts were down your street. They weren't necessary. Common law courts aren't necessarily controlled by the state. Now, they could be controlled by the county. They may not even be a part of they may not even be a part of the state. They don't have to be. Common law, like marriage. We consider common law, or let's say the basic governing of the people in a local vicinity. Let's say in Massachusetts, prostitution's illegal. All these blue laws are in effect, where across the state border, those things aren't the same. And within a state, you may have more Puritans where they have more constrained blue or more blue laws, and other parts of the same state, not so many. The point is that common law is very fluid to meeting the people's needs for justice, where government is in our constitutional republic. This is something that I think Mason was missing. In our constitutional republic, our government only had legal jurisdiction over those things granted. Thomas Jefferson, as a lawyer, pointed out that the criminal jurisdiction in 1798 that the federal government had based on the Constitution, they could not try a person for a crime unless it was counterfeiting or treason. All other laws that they would be prosecuted in a federal court would be things that would be laws broken outside the United States. In other words, laws against the laws of nations. That means you're in a different nation and you violated their law. Or law upon the high seas. You're in international water and now you're under maritime law. So the point is that the federal government would never drag you into a court over a crime that you've committed, because the only crimes, unless you were actually violating, like not paying a tax or something like that, when you really look at what was to be qualified, Thomas Jefferson really clarified that. And that's why the federal courts started really trying to reach more and more, because they didn't have enough to do. And that's why in 1800 with John Marshall, he became the real, parchment breaker, because he started taking jurisdiction as a judicial review, that concept of judicial review, which is not constitutional. There's nowhere in the Constitution where the courts have the ability to take an active role in picking up law cases. If they don't have original jurisdiction, they're to wait for the appeal. But in Marshall's case, he didn't wait for an appeal. He reached down to an inferior court with Marbury v. Madison and basically pulled that up with judicial review and got into the knickers of a case that was being handled. Who knows? Marbury may not have ever considered an appeal. So Marshall did him a favor, because Marshall wanted to go after Jefferson, who was shutting down this expanse of the court system. They wanted this. Hamilton wanted this because he saw the court necessary at this point in time, at this juncture, with Thomas Jefferson coming in, expanding the reach and the power of the court was essential to basically start being able to undermine this new administration coming in. And oh, by the way, if you look under the history of the first treason trial outside of the Whiskey Rebellion, it was with Aaron Burr, who was to be tried for treason for what he did down in New Orleans. And Marshall traveled down there, and because Thomas Jefferson couldn't, basically Marshall threw out a bunch of evidence. So when you really look at what happened, this was how Marshall was basically going after Thomas Jefferson, because Jefferson was Hamilton's enemy, and Marshall was a protege for Hamilton. So, hey, you attack my mentor, then I'm going to make you miserable. And so these guys carried these agendas, and Marshall was a big-time agenda carrier. As a matter of fact, Russell Kirk, in a conservative mind from, I think, Eliot to Burke, or Burke to Eliot, something like that. It's a philosophical book that Russell Kirk writes. he exposes Marshall as being a sycophant for Hamilton. He was his number one fan. So, I digress. I gave you a little history there, but the point is that I don't believe Mason was understanding this hard restriction because, you know what, I think he had to, but it doesn't fit his narrative. He has to kind of give everybody the idea that the federal courts and the federal system had jurisdiction over everything. Because if that's so, then that puts fear in you, because then that's how they can assume powers and do bad things. But as Pendleton really laid it out, their jurisdiction was limited. And oh, guess what? The next topic we're going to hit with Madison is jurisdiction. So, I'm sorry, keep going with what Mason's saying there. Thank you.
Okay. Gentlemen will perhaps say there will be no occasion to carry up the evidence by viva... How do you say it? You say voce.
Yeah, so by voice.
Viva voce.
So viva voce. Voce, voca. Viva. It's by voice. In other words, they're bringing up evidence by voice. In other words, it's all okay. It's all word. It's not written. And it's not hard evidence. Go ahead.
Okay. Carrying up the evidence by viva voce testimony because Congress may order it to be committed to writing and transmitted in that manner with the rest of the record. It is true they may, but it is as true that they may not. But suppose they do, little conversant as I am in this subject, I know there is a great difference between viva voce evidence given at the bar and testimony given in writing. I leave it to gentlemen more conversant in these matters to discuss it. They are also to have cognizance and controversies to which the United States shall be a party. This power is superadded, and there might be no doubt that all cases arising under the government might be brought before the federal court. Gentlemen will not, I presume, deny that all revenue and excise controversies and all proceedings relative to the duties of officers of government, from the highest to the lowest, may and must be brought by these means to the federal courts, in the first instance to the inferior federal court, and afterwards to the superior court. Every fact proved with respect to these in the court below may be revived in the superior court. But this appellate jurisdiction is to be under the regulations of Congress. What these regulations may be, God only knows.
Okay.
Their jurisdiction.
Let me just jump in here. Because, okay, again, like with Pendleton, or I should say with, who was it before that? Henry, whatever. As we looked at how they set these things up, they're creating testimony that is based upon the current Constitution. And yes, there were problems with that last half of original jurisdiction, if states are a party, or if it's a citizen or a foreigner with another state, blah, blah, blah. And so all of that got changed by the 11th Amendment, because these are legitimate points that they're bringing up. That's why the 11th Amendment was drafted. Shoot, let me look it up again, because I do have it. It's in our color-coded Constitution. And that's why, you know, I always refer to that. It was drafted and proposed in 1794 and ratified in 1798. So in other words, the state stepped up and said, you know what? We're tired of you doing this. So you no longer have original jurisdiction in these cases, and only appellate jurisdiction if it arises under the Constitution. If it does not arise under the Constitution, then the state Supreme Court has final say.
All right, their jurisdiction further extends to controversies between citizens of different states. Can we not trust our state courts with the decision of these? If I have a controversy with a man in Maryland, if a man in Maryland has my bond for £100, are not the state courts competent to try it? Is it suspected that they would enforce the payment if unjust, or refuse to enforce it if just? The very idea is ridiculous. And then he has, what, with an exclamation mark, carry me 1,000 miles from home, from my family and business, to where perhaps it will be impossible for me to prove that I paid it? Perhaps I have a respectable witness who saw me pay the money, but I must carry him 1,000 miles to prove it, or be compelled to pay it again. Is there any necessity for this power? It ought to have no unnecessary or dangerous power. Why should the federal courts have this cognizance? Is it because one lives on one side of the Potomac and the other on the other? Suppose I have your bond for £1,000. If I have any wish to harass you, or if I be of a litigious disposition, I have only to assign it to a gentleman in Maryland. This assignment will involve you in trouble and expense. What effect will this power have between British creditors and the citizens of this state? This is a ground on which I shall speak with confidence. Everyone who heard me speak on the subject knows that I always spoke for the payment of the British debts. I wish every honest debt to be paid. Though I would wish to pay British creditor, yet I would not put it in his power to gratify private malice or to our injury. Let me be put right if I be mistaken, but there is not, in my opinion, a single British creditor but can bring his debtors to the federal court.
Okay, so the Constitution was going to allow that to happen by giving a foreigner the ability to come to the federal courts. So, as you know, and just there's a lot of people out there that said, and maybe this was one of the ways that British creditors were getting, because I'm not convinced that it was rampant, but the courts may have been ruling in favor of the British creditor. But to be clear, the 11th Amendment stepped up and said, you're not doing this anymore. And that was it. If it didn't arise under the Constitution, such as a financial debt that is contracted outside the federal government's purview, they don't have any appeal case. If it's, you know, a debt with a corporation or a foreigner with a state, doesn't matter. They are not involved. And so at that point in time, as a matter of fact, the Assumption Act didn't occur either. The Assumption Act was just basically taking on overall state debt that they owed Continental Congress. There are other debts that the states have taken on prior to the Continental Congress, the Revolutionary War, and so forth. So there may have been some debt and those types of things that, you know, might have been out there. But the fact is, there's really no evidence that the Constitution was designed to pay Britain. We were not subjects to Britain. There was this concept of trying to create this, you know, it wasn't British intended. And when you go through the Constitutional Convention, there was never any conversation, oh, we want to make sure we're subjects of Britain by doing this. And as a matter of fact, the 11th Amendment killed the argument, because the states came in and said, this is happening in a way we don't like it, and we're ending it. So, anyway, let's go down to now my hero, James Madison, and this is on Friday the 20th, so a new day has, you know, one day's ended and a new day has begun. And Madison actually ended the conversation on Thursday, comes back in, and he still has the floor. And this is the days where, you know, you were given unlimited time. So the grandstanding by Henry and the grandstanding by Mason was, you know, prolific. You know, these guys were out there trying to really rehash the same arguments and getting, you know, people to, you know, buy into their new version of a bad argument. So with that, as I can see, we're almost out of time. We'll be going straight into it. So Tammy, hold on. We'll dive into this. As we move forward, Madison is going to dive into the jurisdiction. There's nobody that's probably more succinct, but again, the vernacular, the speech, the words that they use is a little bit different. So sometimes it's not crystal clear to an English speaker today, But when you really read what they're right to the point. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, wow, I really cut it close there, but that's so typical. I'm surprised how fast I can get. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. You know, yeah, I've even said it faster, like in half a second. But anywho, I don't like doing that. And so let's dive into Madison here. This is first called a note, and I'll probably change the header. But nevertheless, it is Friday the 20th. And Madison is now standing up, and this is a notable comment in refuting what was stated the day before. So go ahead. Thank you so much.
Okay. The second question, which I proposed to consider, was whether such organization be made as would be safe and convenient for the states and the people at large. Let us suppose that the subjects of its jurisdiction are only enumerated and power given to the general legislature to establish such courts as might be judged necessary and expedient. Do not think that, in that case, any rational objection could be made to it, any more than would be made to a general power of legislation in certain enumerated cases. If that would be safe, this appears to me better and more restrictive, so far as it may be abused by extension of power. The most material part is the discrimination of superior and inferior jurisdiction and the arrangement of its power as where it shall have original and where appellate cognizance. Where it speaks of appellate jurisdiction, it expressly provides that such regulations will be made as will accommodate every citizen so far as predictable, practicable in any government. The principal criticism which has been made was against the appellate cognizance as well of fact as law. I am happy that the honorable member who presides and who is familiarly acquainted with the subject does not think it involves anything unnecessarily dangerous. I think that the distinction of fact as well as law may be satisfied by the discrimination of the civil and common law. But if gentlemen should contend that appeals as to fact can be extended to jury cases, I contend that, by the word regulations, it is the power of Congress to prevent it, or prescribe such a mode as will secure the privilege of jury trial. They may make a regulation to prevent such appeals entirely, or they may remand the fact or send it to an inferior contiguous court to be tried, or otherwise preserve that ancient and important trial.
A jury trial. Now, he covers a few different things here. And as a matter of fact, he kind of puts it up there. He says, let us suppose that the subjects of its jurisdiction are only enumerated and power given to the general legislature to establish such courts as might be judged necessary and expedient. You know, he's pointing out that, you know, they're not there to, the courts have not been sold as the ability to expand government in doing anything. They're only limited to things under the enumerations. It kind of covers this, but he goes down and talks a little bit more about the extension of their power, you know, and so forth. And he talks about the inference of law and so forth. Down at the very bottom, Madison then says, but if gentlemen should contend that appeals as to fact can be extended to jury cases, I contend that by the word regulations, it is in the power of Congress to prevent it. In other words, Congress has the full control over that court. And their job is to not let that court become the beast in the room. Their job is to ensure, but so this is where the states have to really control Congress in making sure the Senate is doing their bidding and making we the people making sure that our representatives are representing us by the Constitution and not allowing the courts to get out of control. They ended up letting them get out of control in 1830s, where the courts started making up their own regulations. Congress abrogated their responsibility in regulating the courts by allowing them to create their own rules of proceedings and procedures, how they were going to function in the court and so forth. And this is when they induced case law and precedents. And I believe that you'll find in why counties matter most. So as we dive forward, Madison then jumps more specifically into jurisdiction, because he was trying to answer the questions, but this is where he really hits the nail on the head regarding jurisdiction. So go ahead.
I have observed that gentlemen suppose that the general legislature will do everything mischievous they possibly can, and that they will omit to do everything good which they are authorized to do. If this were a reasonable supposition, their objections would be good. I consider it reasonable to conclude that they will as readily do their duty as deviate from it. Nor do I go on the grounds mentioned by gentlemen on the other side that we are to place unlimited confidence in them and expect nothing but the most exalted integrity and sublime virtue. But I go on this great republican principle that the people will have virtue and intelligence to select men of virtue and wisdom. Is there no virtue among us? If there be not, we are in a wretched situation. No theoretical checks, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea.
Yeah, chimerical idea. And so that's a perfect point to stop with. Okay, so the very first thing Madison says, this very first line, I have observed the gentleman, in other words, these anti-federalists, suppose that the general government will do everything mischievous they possibly can, and that they will omit to do everything good which they are authorized to do. That has been every argument coming out of the anti-federalists. Have I not said that in so many different ways? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. You hear me say, Henry's doing it, Mason's doing it. All of these anti-federalists are trying to twist things, and that's exactly what they're saying. That, one, they're going to do things they don't have the authority to do, and they're not going to do the things that they're supposed to do. So this is how this is all evil, and the Constitution's the problem. Well, hold on here. The Constitution's not the problem. It's the virtue, because he points this out later as he starts talking about this. He says, but I go on this great Republican principle that the people will have virtue and intelligence to select men of virtue and wisdom. You hear me every day, folks, tell you about full compliance to the Constitution. The day we hold our public servants accountable to full compliance, the day they stop extracting our blood and the marrow from our bones, it's over. They'll no longer be able to do it, because they'll only be able to do those things that are authorized because we're holding them accountable. Moving on, Madison says, is there no virtue among us? Well, at that point in time, maybe they had a lot of virtue, and I think they did. But today, where is our virtue? Our virtue has been wretched because of our school, because our government has gained control over these things and has perverted us literally to destroy ourselves. This is how they get away with waging warfare tactics against us, and we are none the wiser that they're waging economic warfare, chemical warfare, biological warfare, all sorts of different warfare tactics, that if our government was doing this into a foreign nation, they would declare war against them. That is how far they've gone, and that is how our virtue has been lost to moral turpitude. Look that up, moral turpitude. So, this is why he says, no theoretical checks, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea. In other words, it is a fantasy. It is, you know, this idea that doesn't exist. It is, you know, it's like, it can only exist in imagination. So, did you look up moral turpitude? I mean, I'll look it up. You go ahead and... Because moral turpitude is basically somebody that is amoral. They have no morals. They possess no morals. Yeah, whatever guides
conduct
them...
Conduct that is inherently base, vile, depraved, or contrary to accepted standards of morality and justice.
There you go. Moral turpitude means your morals and everything, your virtue is gone. So let's go ahead and pick it up from if there be sufficient virtue.
Okay, if there be sufficient virtue and intelligence in the community, it will be exercised in the selection of these men, so that we do not depend on their virtue or put confidence in our rulers, but in the people who are to choose them.
Mm-hmm.
Having taken this general view of this subject, I will now advert to what has fallen from the honorable gentleman who presides. His criticism is that the judiciary has not been guarded from an increase of the salary of the judges. I wished myself to insert a restraint on the augmentation as well as diminution of their compensation and supported it in the convention. But I was overruled. I must state the reasons which were urged. They had great weight. The business must increase. If there was no power to increase their pay according to the increase of business during the life of the judges, it might happen that there would be such an accumulation of business as would reduce the pay to a most trivial consideration. This reason does not hold as to the president, for in short period in which he presides, this cannot happen. His salary ought not therefore to be increased. It was objected yesterday that there was no provision for a jury from the vicinage. If it could have been done with safety, it would not have been opposed. I might so happen that a trial would be impracticable in the county. Suppose a rebellion in a whole district. Would it not be impossible to get a jury? The trial by jury is held as sacred in England as it is in America.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my place. There are deviations from it in England, yet greater deviations have happened here since we established our independence than have taken place there for a long time, though it be left to the legislative discretion. I'm going to pause there because there's a highlighted red.
Yeah. So I'm going to go up. Thank you. I want to go up towards a little bit higher up because Madison points something out about the Constitutional Convention, right? You notice that? He said he was talking about the money and guarding against, you know, the avarice and the, you know, the lust for money and so forth. I wished myself to insert a restraint on the augmentation as well as the diminution of their compensation and supported it in the convention. But I was overruled in the convention. In other words, they kind of wanted the ability to grant them their own salaries, their, you know, to be able to, you know, have control over what they're paying themselves. And so Madison was against that. We didn't highlight that because it's just one of those things that may be the root of all evil, but it is what it is. I think that there was even conversation of allowing the states to set the standard. And I honestly think that understanding the size of this republic and understanding what it takes for a person to be here, you know, let's just say Estonia. We got Estonia as a new state that just joined the union. And they may not have the money to really help pay for the travel and residing, you know, in the District of Columbia while they're serving their people across the Atlantic Ocean to, you know, and the northern part of the of Europe. So the point I'm trying to make here is with Estonia, it may be more of a financial hardship for them to be there. The question goes down this way. Do we need all of our governing people in the same room? The day the Constitution was created, we did. Because we had no ability to have real-time government. Because real-time means you can be virtual. Real-time means you don't have to be there. You can be there in mind, eye, ears, in every way, but in harm's way. That's what the military has been working and working. You got to understand, why did the military invent the internet? Because it would open the door towards real-time war fighting. Because now you don't have to, you know, deploy everybody. Now, isn't it interesting that even to this day, well, you know, they're getting better at this, but the old war horses of the generals of the 80s, you know, going into the 90s when the internet was pretty much out of the bag, right? Now we had the internet out there. So why was it that we had to deploy all forces into SWA, Southwest Asia, to go into Iraq? Any ideas? Well, the problem was that they had the mindset that they wanted to have everything in their disposal. They didn't trust the internet. They didn't trust technology. So they continued into the early 2000s with this concept. It was proven by the use of politics, because politics started controlling. The more the internet and this virtual governing, this virtual war fighting became more and more realistic, the faster the politicians got their hands on it. In other words, the old structure, the old command structure was of such that the president would basically delegate to his generals their mission, and they would make the decisions of how to accomplish that. Well, that's gone away by the wayside now, because instead of dictating, they basically give you kind of overview of what you're going to be doing, and they want to call the shots. And the lawyers, actually, most military people will tell you, it is the lawyers that is usually on the other end from them in the battlefield telling them what they can do, what they can't do. Because we don't want to be held accountable in fighting and prosecuting war on foreign soil. I submit to you that the Army has no business being there. The Air Force has no business being there. And if we're going to be there, it should be the Navy and the Marine Corps just to do our job. And it's not to basically be hosting and maintaining what we would call regimes. America should be very clear. If you want our assistance, we will assist you in becoming a state in the Union, because that is a delegated responsibility given to Congress. Congress may admit states into the Union. There's nowhere in there that we're there to protect foreign states at all. We don't have any job in being vested into maintaining regimes because we like the money or what we're, you know, how it's making our corporations money. All of those types of things are not legitimate for our government to be involved in. This is starting to make sense, isn't it? So that when we really look at what the military should be doing, we're to be the best guarded nation that nobody could ever touch us. And that our Navy and Marine Corps would be able to take care of any threat anywhere in the world and ensure that our lanes of commerce going through the seas of the world are never harassed. That was the point. And there was an opportunity for us to basically say, hey, we're only doing this for our ships. You want us to do this? This would have been an opportunity for other nations to basically give money to the United States to be able to say, you know, while you're guarding ships, could you guard ours too? Because that would cost us money. It would cost us lives. I mean, that could be big. But when you look at it today, how big is pirating? Well, pirating is really bad for those nations that, you know, fly those flags where they go, okay, they're not going to get mad at us because they have no navy. But they think twice about ever attacking any ship carrying an American flag. Now, when they're really bold and brazen, they want to actually go after Americans, then, there's this term, right? You screw around, you find out. So, my point is that when we really start looking at what these constraints are and what they're supposed to be doing, you know, and the salaries and everything that we've been going through over the course of the past couple of months, it is clear that constitutional compliance is the only way we get unfettered from all of the global agendas that are basically stemming from the United States or coming into the United States. You want to have your liberty, and you want to be able to live in the most protected, free state of the world, because if we do that, then every state in the union would want to actually get away from these regimes. They would want to have their liberty, other than those theocracies, such as communism. Those communist states where the people really... But I'm telling you, most people in communist states aren't on board with communism. Might I remind you of Tiananmen Square? Might I remind you that in all of the communist states, the people have tried to uprise, but they've never seen ever a glimpse of hope in the world. If we were doing our job, they would see that glimpse and they would be calling for us to basically bring liberty to them. But instead, we've been playing politics and regime control and globalism, and that is all unconstitutional. Period. End of story. Okay, so there we go. Let me just get it back to, though it be left to legislative discretion, again, the legislature is to control the courts. It is their job. And that should be the same in the states as well. I believe the language in most state constitutions say that the state legislature will regulate the court. The courts can't make law. I mean, for the most part, this was carried out. I would think that when you start looking at the later constitutions, there are probably shenanigans. I know there are shenanigans in later constitutions where states are being subjugated and so forth, and maybe the language, regulations, and controls of the courts may not be as prevalent or may be, you know, as bold as in the earlier states. So anyway, go ahead. Keep on going. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. It is a misfortune, in any case, that this trial should be departed from. Yet in some cases, it is necessary. It must be, therefore, left to the discretion of the legislature to modify it according to circumstances. This is a complete and satisfactory answer. It was objected that this jurisdiction would extend to all cases and annihilate the state's courts. At this moment of time, it might happen that there are many disputes between citizens of different states. But in the ordinary state of things, I believe that any gentleman will think that the far greater number of cases, 99 out of 100, will remain with the state judiciaries. All controversies directly between citizen and citizen will still remain with the local courts. The number of cases within the jurisdiction of these courts is very small when compared to those in which the local tribunals will have cognizance. No accurate calculation can be made, but I think that any gentleman who will contemplate the subject at all must be struck with this truth.
Now, this is when Madison started speaking too softly. And I think, because I'm looking at how he was rounding this all up here, but in the ordinary state of things, I believe that any gentleman will think that the far greater number of causes, 99 out of 100, will remain with the state judiciaries. Here he's saying it. I mean, they don't have the jurisdiction. There's no need to go with all of the types of cases. They wouldn't go up. All controversies directly between citizen and citizen will remain with the local courts. The number of cases within the jurisdiction of these courts is very small when compared to those in which the local tribunals have cognizance. No accurate calculation can be made, but I think that any gentleman who contemplate the subject at all must be struck with this truth. If it's arising under the Constitution, as Article 3 states, then they will have appeal, and they may even have original jurisdiction only in those specific cases of original jurisdiction where they spell it out with admiralty, I think, admiralty and maritime. Anyway, the point is here, folks, that Madison was really trying to, you know, help them actualize that there was no need to fear. If the courts started going out of their way in pulling in, which is what they started trying to do, why did they try to do that? Now, if you have a job and you really don't have much to do and you realize that your salary is kind of marginal, then it's really hard for you to say, I deserve more money, because look at how hard I'm not working. I need more money. That just doesn't fly very well, right? Ah, but if you have backlogs and you've got all of these things and all these big pressing things and you're doing all this stuff, then it's a little bit easier to justify higher pay. Hey, and we already saw in the in going through the Northwest Ordinance, because we've gone through that, we've already seen some of these things where the courts were already being kind of overpaid. Well, why were the judges being overpaid? Because they had to entice very well-educated men to go live and reside in a state of nothing. In other words, we're moving you out to the Northwest Territory. We're moving you out to Wyoming. And, you know, even though you've lived and you're a resident of New York, you're now going to be out there. I don't want to go out there. They got to incentivize you somehow, right? So in some ways, they had to do those things because it's got to be a free market. The federal government couldn't go into, you know, any type of profession, whether it be law, whether it be business, anything, and say, you have to be there. And we're moving you out there, and we're not compensating you. You're on your own, and we're forcing you to be there. It's almost the same thing as taking away their liberty or their property, which means that, oh, okay, now you get due process. But I'm hoping you're seeing this point, that when it came down to it, the courts didn't have enough to do. So they started aggrandizing, well, we'll do this, and we'll hear this. And Marshall put it on steroids. Keep in mind, folks, the 11th Amendment was the first iteration before Marshall even showed up on the courts. So the states already got kind of fed up with this passive approach, with what the courts were doing was far more passive than what Marshall started doing in 1800. So, you know, if you can appreciate the fact that the states already did and they felt they did a good enough job, Marshall literally put them on steroids and doing other things, and nobody saw it coming. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.